This episode is presented by Invest Puerto Rico. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Hello and welcome back to Equity. This is an Equity Shot. We are diving into all things LinkedIn, China, Microsoft, regulatory, and tension-filled. It's going to be an absolute blast. I have Danny Crichton with me. Danny, hello. This is the weekend officially for everyone tuning in. How you doing?
It's good. It's not the weekend yet, but another 20 more meetings on this Friday, and we're almost there.
Well, we're putting this out on the weekend, so technically everyone listening is this is Saturday, so hi, you know. Congratulations on making it to the weekend. What's not going to make it to the weekend, though, is LinkedIn in China. Big news out this week from Redmond, where the software company is based. Danny, this feels like a long time coming, and I'm not super surprised by it, but it did drop seemingly out of the sky. So what's the context for people out there who are catching up on this story?
I mean, for years, LinkedIn was the only Western or US-based social network that was in China. You know, Facebook has famously been cut out of the Middle Kingdom for literally its entire existence.
Yes.
Twitter hasn't been accessible. Wikipedia is not available. You know, go down the list, there's almost nothing except for LinkedIn. And for reasons that are always been a little bit mysterious, Microsoft has been able to sort of dodge a lot of the constraints around social networks that have been placed on other Western companies, partly because they have Microsoft Azure, Windows, and a couple other products that are obviously very important on the mainland. So LinkedIn has been there since, I believe, 2014, if I'm doing my math correctly. And for the last 6 or 7 years, it's grown up. It's been mostly focused on professional social network, no different than sort of the United States. So it tends to have less political coverage, less controversy, unlike Twitter, you know, TikTok or Facebook, up until the last couple of months. In these last couple of months, China has been cutting down quite aggressively on social network, on media in general. And 2 weeks ago, the Chinese version of LinkedIn basically shut out a bunch of U.S. journalists from the platform, basically banned them from having profiles on the mainland. And then we found out, Wednesday or yesterday, that Microsoft was going to completely pull out of China when it comes to the LinkedIn product.
Yeah, and that's going to come by the end of the year. But I want to go back even further down into March. I think we didn't really pay a lot of attention to this when it happened, but I'm describing from a New York Times headline that I have pulled up here. China punishes Microsoft's LinkedIn over lax censorship. That's from March of this year. So to me, the decisions to later censor journalist profiles probably came from Microsoft trying to live up to the wrist slap that it got from the CCP earlier this year. And so it made a little bit more sense to see once I had gone back and done some research on the context of this. But all that's to say, even though this feels like it fell out of the sky, like an anvil onto some sort of like Disney character, no, it's actually a long time coming. And this is there were, I don't know, rumblings in the background that we should have caught. Frankly, I feel a little bit like I should have known better.
Well, this isn't unique to Microsoft, right? So the Chinese government has been cracking down on ByteDance, which owns TikTok or Douyin on the mainland. There's been an incredible focus on basically controlling the narrative on a lot of these social network platforms. So ByteDance has hired tens of thousands of content moderators.
Yes.
Alibaba and Tencent has done the same on their related networks. And so, you know, in many ways, this is just sort of the mainstream issue that all tech companies in China are facing these days, which is a vastly different regulatory environment than they were experiencing even 1 year ago.
Yeah. And doesn't seem to be hitting pause. The changes keep coming. And this is not just an economic thing. This is also hitting culture and so forth. I mean, China's government banned certain celebrity fan clubs they thought were insalubrious to the youth. They're banning video game time. It's really... I don't want to say a whole cloth remaking, but it's certainly a turn of the ship when it comes to how the government is sticking itself into the lives of Chinese people. But I think, Danny, that when you think about the technology angle by itself, this pullout by Microsoft is kind of the end of the attempt to bridge the gap between China's internet and the global internet. It feels like this was the last major link across the two that was owned by a U.S. company.
I think that's right. I mean, when you look at the data and the history of the last 20 years, you know, American companies for years have been trying to get access, particularly technology companies.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there is hardware access. So Apple is obviously very popular with iPhones on the mainland. But when it comes to the media side of things, it has always been very, very tricky. Even search engines, Google famously pulled out of China in 2010 over a fight around a hack on Gmail that was related to Tibetan separatists. And so they had made the decision to move to Hong Kong, redirect .cn users to the .hk users, and have not been back since. Obviously, again, Facebook was never given access. So Microsoft was sort of the one-off person that was sort of able to do both. They had invested a lot not just in building out, I think, the infrastructure for LinkedIn, but Microsoft has thousands of AI jobs in its research center in multiple Chinese cities, and has always kind of invested heavily to try to bridge that gap. And I think you're absolutely right, Alex. Times have changed, and I think it's become much clearer that trying to bridge that gap is basically impossible for most tech companies today.
Yeah, and one thing that I was thinking about in the context of this and kind of major software companies and where China sits is I'm like, well, you know, they do use Windows still. You know, it's still very popular in China. It's pirated quite often, but, you know, it's still the, kind of the OS of record. And so I did a little digging, Danny, and two Chinese companies, CS2C and Tianjin Kailan, in 2019 announced they were going to join forces and they were going to essentially work together to make a homegrown OS that could replace Windows. Digging a little bit closer to the recent time, seems to still be a couple years out. I don't think it's going to make a 2022 deadline, but they did use the Kailan system in some recent space tech. And so it's kind of getting out there into the world. The question is, how good is a Chinese Communist Party approved OS going to be? I'm not optimistic that it's going to be fantastic and better than Windows 11, but certainly that would further decouple China's kind of computing world from ours.
Well, there's a lot of focus on strategic autonomy, right? And so when you look at the OSs, there's a huge goal to sort of build everything in-house. You want to control the process soup to nuts. I'm sure the CCP version of Windows will have great desktop wallpaper. You probably yes. can't choose what it will be.
No.
I will say as a fun fact that North Korea actually has its own version of Linux called Red Star OS.
It does. I knew that
and
too.
It's fairly locked down, as one could imagine. But like I think, look, it's a big country. It's a big market. And I think there's an immense amount of opportunity still when you have 1.3 billion consumers, almost all of whom are online, all of whom are spending heavily in all these different products. But the fear has been over the last couple of years, and particularly over the last year for the CCP, that the tech companies have just gone too big, too powerful, yes. too independent, yes. too allowed to run their own ship and their own narrative, and the reins are going back onto them. So, I think Microsoft made the right move here. I don't think they had a choice. I'm glad that they sort of chose to do this expeditiously and just sort of, you know, they didn't fight it for 2 years and have a whole battle over it. I think the writing was on the wall. But that leads to a big question, because Microsoft doesn't just own Windows or LinkedIn. It also owns GitHub. And GitHub yeah. is by far one of the most important repositories of all code, open source, closed source, doesn't matter. And there's a huge challenge. There's been a debate for the last couple of years about what China's going to do about GitHub. Because for yes. developers on the mainland, they need access to all this code. Yet it is also a repository for all kinds of information and data that the CCP, by and large, wants to censor. And there's been a huge conflict over there.
Yeah, and I'll throw in there that there's actually some use of GitHub by certain people in China to get around certain speech rules and so forth. So there's actually kind of a bit of a revolutionary tie-in there. I will say that if you're not familiar, Beijing is building its own version of a Git-style tool. It's called Gitee, or maybe Gitee, one of the two. It's G-I-T-E-E. And it's like GitLab, it's like GitHub, but it's from Beijing. So I don't know if it's better or worse or whatever, but that's another tool they can put out and then begin to preclude access to other products out there and then further kind of like siloize themselves. My general impression, Danny, and I have to talk about my own politics here, but like as a capitalist and as someone who's been to more than one place in the world and has met lots of folks, is that there's a lot of folks everywhere who are pretty smart and do cool things. And I don't think even one country as large as China will be able to out-innovate the world.
I think that's right. I mean, look, famously, the Japanese computer science market is actually quite cloistered compared to the rest of the market. So there's a lot of folks who try to bridge the Japanese AI research community to the U.S. research community. I think the same thing will show up in China. Some of that, in the Japanese case, is a language barrier. In China's case, obviously, it's going to be a political barrier. There's an opportunity when you're not in the mainstream, right, that you can do different things. There's opportunities to be original. You can actually control a lot of products. They'll go in different directions. So I can imagine just from the fact there's now two people working on the same thing that you will get some additional innovation. But these projects move so quickly that without access to the global repository of knowledge that goes on around computer science and AI, like, I don't know how it's tenable. My assumption is that certain projects will be allowed across the firewall on a case-by-case basis. It will be brought yes. into GITI. Not so dissimilar from how Linux has package managers and you can sort of upstream different packages onto your OS. And sometimes there's folks who are checking the security of those before it comes down to you. So
yep.
My guess is they're going to find a hybrid model that works for them. That it doesn't bode well, I think, if you are a Chinese AI researcher wanting to be at the edge of the field.
No, absolutely not. And I think, you know, the one thing I was looking for in the kind of Q3 venture capital data was a slowdown in China. I was really expecting, you know, given the last couple of months of regulatory crackdown, that there would be a you know, dissipation of capital flowing into Chinese startups. Not really, according to the data that I've seen so far. So I'm curious where that money is going and what that kind of says about the future of the Chinese technology world. But let's pivot back to the Git discussion and talk a little bit about GitLab. Danny, did you track this IPO? You and I haven't talked as much in the last week as we usually do, so I don't know where you are on GitLab.
I didn't track the IPO. I've tracked the company for years. I've always been a huge fan of GitLab. One of the most original, you know, open source, fully remote companies, very yes. kind of stridently unique in that way. And it's just a great product. I mean, if you talk to engineers, at least my engineering friends, and I don't want to open up any massive, you know, wars going on over tooling, but I will say GitLab has a very good reputation, has done very, very well, has grown tremendously. And even a couple of years ago, it was getting valuations that shocked people when it came to revenue multiples, which probably leads into the IPO.
Well, yes, but I want to pause on the product point, because I got some tweets yesterday talking about this, because I was getting on the phone with the CEO, Sid, who I've known for a year or two now. And I, you know, I just did my usual thing. I'm like, hey, talking to the CEO, if you have any questions, you know, pop off and I'll grab some good ones and include them in my list. And people were like in two camps. There was the GitLab sucks, GitHub rules camp. And then there was the GitLab is great, GitHub sucks camp. And I was like, I didn't even know there was a holy war here. And I just stumbled into one. It's like opening the door and everyone's fighting, like, oh, I'm going to close that door. But it's great to see, back to your point, two competing products, similar space, battling it out for supremacy. And there does seem to be ample room for both of them, given the company's growth. It's on a $232.5 million run rate, worth, according to MarketWatch, right before we jumped on the podcast here, roughly $15 billion. That gives it, Danny, a revenue multiple of 38,419.7, which I cannot fully understand. And so I was hoping you could tell me from the venture perspective, why it priced at 77, which was way above its raised range, and then and why it's now worth $100 a share. I'm confused.
I mean, it's the best of breed when it comes to SaaS, right? If we're talking about hundreds of different SaaS companies, I think traditionally GitLab has really built up a reputation of having best-in-class metrics, best-in-class operating leverage. You know, again, they're fully remote, so they don't have offices. You actually get rid of even some margin that other SaaS companies that are best of breed don't have either. And when it comes to the product, they're in the space where there is a network effect to these sorts of repository products, because you're working with different development teams. They've got to work on one shared resource. So you're the system of record for all code. And, yes. You know, when you look at this market, yes, GitHub, there's GitLab. There's a few other players. There's one that went to a private equity company a few years ago that runs something called Depot, and I'm forgetting
yes,
its name right now.
Yes, I remember that transaction. Yeah,
yeah. That was when I was at Google. That was the code base mechanism, repository mechanism back then. Look, I think it's done extraordinarily well. And look, their competitor is GitHub, which is owned by Microsoft. And I think there's an assumption in the market that, look, if you're best of breed competing against the stolid, you know, competitor that's a big tech company that's probably not making a huge amount of investment, you can do a lot of damage. Now, I think it's interesting because GitHub, to me, is one of the few acquisitions I think has been super successful. Nat Friedman, very smart guy, running the company over there, doing very successful things. GitHub has expanded tremendously. So, you know, part of this is also the secular trend of just the number of developers in the world. You know, code yes. is just getting more important to the economy. There's more people using it. And so you have this huge wave of, think of all the Gen Zers who are currently coding on you know, Roblox or Minecraft, who are going to become the engineers of the future. They're all going to be on GitLab in 10 years. Huge, huge,
Danny,
you know, tailwinds behind them.
You do know that we work with some Gen Z people. They're not nine.
You know, the bolus of the people.
The bolus of the people. Yes,
the bolus
that is
of
how
the
we
people.
That's how Danny refers to children. what I want to say is, you know, looking at GitLab at its IPO price of $77 a share, it was the fourth or fifth best valued SaaS company in revenue multiple terms in the market, and now it's appreciated even greater. And so now it's probably top three in the world, which is pretty impressive. Danny, what I was struck by was the fact they started there out the gate. They showed up, they went public, and they earned essentially a bronze medal valuation, you know, on day one. And I think in the older days, you had to go public and then earn that a little bit more. And I'm curious if you think this will lead other unicorns to try to jump in the pool, given that this just got a bear hug from public investors.
I mean, just one data point among many, right? I think people are looking at the full data set. I think they're seeing a lot of positive numbers across the board. Outside of our discussion on the equity podcast of Rent the Runway, which is running into a little turbulence on the runway, mostly because they're running out of runway. The reality is if you don't have physical products, I mean, could you imagine two companies that are more opposed, right? GitLab is in the cloud. It has amazing network effects, unbelievable operating leverage versus you're managing physical inventory in stores and you're mailing dresses out over shipping lines.
Yeah, and you have to buy the dresses. You have enormous CapEx. I mean,
you have depreciation. And then you have depreciation for all this stuff. So look, it's an amazing business. It's in line with most other SaaS companies. It's another notch in the hat for the model. You know, think 5 years ago, we were still struggling to get SaaS companies out into the public markets. It's just another real strength.
Yeah. And just to put a little cap on what Danny was saying earlier about kind of best in class metrics, I just grabbed some numbers for us. In 2020, a pandemic year that had much turbulence, GitLab had net retention of 148%, a number that got slightly better. And now it's 152% in the first half of this year. Danny, any enterprise SaaS company that has net retention over 125 is sitting pretty. 150 is, in my experience, very rare at scale. Not that hard when you've got two customers, but like, you know, once you have an actual customer base, it's super
impressive. Look, it's also dollar retention, right? So they're pulling in not only more users, they're also raising the amount of money per user with advanced features, which is what they've been offering for the last couple of years. So across the board, very, very strong. And, you know, I would use the term anti-fragile. You know, when the pandemic hit, it actually became stronger because it was already remote. You didn't have to change everyone to work from home. That's how they operated the last couple of years. And their customers had to do the same thing, which became even more important if you're working on code. So altogether, I think it's a very strong company, best of breed, and I think they're getting the premium they deserve for that. Of course, that begs a huge question, which is as these premiums get higher and higher and higher, one wonders, can these companies actually grow into the premium that they're being affixed? That, to me, is still a very open question. It is very expensive, let's be clear.
It is. I tried to ask Sid about their net retention and if that helped them get to revenue predictability ahead of their IPO, and he declined to answer that directly. Just going to point that out. And last thing here, Danny, looking back in time, 2019, late, GitLab raises money from the private markets at like a $2.7 billion pre, roughly $3 billion post-money valuation. Now it's worth 15. So who is the real villain here? Is it the Wall Street bankers or is it the venture capitalists? When it comes to underpricing,
we always talk to these things. I think the revenue versus valuation back in 2019, I think would be even more insane. So I actually think it was very ambitious then, and it's still ambitious, and they've grown into it a little bit better. So to me, like again, it's the pandemic effect going on here. I actually think no one actually made a mistake here.
That is the most generous, polite, kind, and loving comment that has ever happened on this podcast.
I mean, it's also 2 years, and 2 years is a long time in enterprise SaaS, and if you continue to grow. Like, we've seen examples where the valuation goes up 4 or 5x in, like, a year.
The Vision Fund doesn't count. You cannot index off of Tiger and the Vision Fund because they are drunk, and therefore they're not acting rationally. Maybe it'll work out. I've done some funny things drunk that worked out fine, but most didn't, and that's that. Anyways, we're out of time. That's that. We adore you all. We're back Monday morning. I'm Alex. That's Danny. We're out of here.